each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey there, everyone. God bless you for tuning in to The Winds of Change. I'm Father Tom Coyce. Happy to be here. And the usual Wednesday crowd gathers out the window of the studio here. God love you all. Let's see, how should I begin? We're in a new year, of course, and but the thing I want to begin with is, before I get to theological and moral and philosophical matters, which always wrinkle our brains, I can't help but start with a topic du jour. The topic of the day one of the topics of the day has to do with the charge against our President Donald Trump of being psychologically incapacitated. There's a wave of political voices that are invoking the 25th Amendment. Now, we don't hear that very often. We hear about the amendments for the right to vote and the anti-slavery, right of citizenship. We hear about the First Amendment, the freedom of religion, and Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. You know, we hear about these amendment things added to the Constitution. And but now we're hearing this 25th Amendment, and we have to stretch our brain a little bit to remember what it is. It's something that was put in, I forget what year, but more recent, in a sort of recent past, that if a president is determined unfit, he can be removed from office. If he's, and I don't know if the word psychological, if the word psychologically unfit is in there or not, but it's probably to be determined in different ways. But today, the aspect of psychological unfitness is being used because the people who are opposing President Trump are not really citing an egregious crime or misdemeanor, which is the other kind of way to remove a president. They're citing the 25th Amendment, resorting to a psychological incapacity. Now, here's what I got to say, and this kind of hurts, but I feel like it's important for us to think about these things because we need to pray about these things. We really need to pray hard. What this reminds me of, and this is what it's a little difficult for me to say, but it reminds me of what I have seen and to some extent experienced within the environs of the church. The church, in a number of instances, seemed to lean pretty heavily on a declaration that, especially this happened, and I suppose it's still happening, but thank goodness I haven't heard of it so much, but it certainly could be. It happened especially with men in the seminary, and we were constantly bombarded by psychological profiles and tests and all. And I got to confess, for the most part, they're kind of fun, I guess you could say, and they add a certain knowledge to your self-awareness, should I say it that way. You need to be aware. Oh, there.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
There we go. That's number one. Here, I got my little chalkboard here. That's the first wrinkled brain of the hour. Thanks, Nick. The charge of psychological unfitness needs to be analyzed a bit. Can there be someone psychologically unfit for a particular office, be it president or priesthood, or teacher or policeman or airline pilot or anything, really, right? And of course, you'd want to say yes. We know of cases where someone has a real deranged psychological problem, and it wouldn't be wise to put a person like that in a powerful administrative office or position. But what I need to shed some light on, my friends, that it often is not so much a psychological illness, but a dispute over how to deal with practical problems in the world. And especially, you could say, it often resorts to not a difference between someone well-adjusted psychologically and someone ill-adjusted psychologically, but it often comes to a distinction or a debate between moral positions. I take this moral position, you take that moral position. And obviously, when someone isn't as erudite or eloquent in expressing the defense of their moral position, you need to change tactics, as it were. And I can't help what when I've heard in the past week or so some of these renewed charges that President Trump is psychologically unfit, I couldn't help but immediately this just pops into my brain immediately. I wonder if it does yours. What I'm saying is, what popped into my brain is those who seem to be so adamantly opposed to him are also adamantly pro-abortion, or even not adamantly, but accepting of. Now, what I want to say is, if you know what that is, and many of the other moral issues that kind of hover around that issue, I could say, now wait a minute, couldn't you say that the complete acceptance and the complete denial that there's anything wrong or bad or evil about the willful legal ending of life before birth within the womb? That's it. Yes, the robot came and issued that warning. Because can you not say very, very convincingly that can exhibit a psychological disorder of a high magnitude, but yet that doesn't enter the mind of any of these folks how should I say, heck bent on removing him. And that's a strange position that we're in. I'm hopeful that some of this will shed light on some of these moral issues. I kind of, I was sort of at first a, tentative supporter of Donald Trump, but when contrasted with what was the opposite, or what the option B was, I felt he's a better chance of pushing us in the right direction instead of going farther down a wrong direction. I'll just say it that way. And the attacks that he's receiving, I'm sure will result in many people coming to the conclusion that, ooh, he must be divisive. So therefore, our next leader is going to have to not be divisive. The next leader is going to have to heal the wounds, so to speak. And I'm pessimistic about that prospect, because it's reminiscent of schoolyard bullies. I say that because when you imagine a schoolyard bully, a schoolyard bully goes up to a more weakling, or a weaker student, and says, "I'll stop beating you up if you give me your lunch money." That's probably the typical example of a bully. I'm sure it is much more sophisticated, and I don't know that happens so much anymore, that exact example. But obviously, bullying does happen, and it can. It almost always involves that aspect in one way or another. You create a chaos, and then you say, go with me, and I'll stop the chaos. So I really think we should be aware of that in this regard, in our nation's political world today, to create as much chaos and antagonism, so that the charge of...
You're going to need a bigger boat.
There, exactly. Very, very good, Nick. The bigger boat that... I like that. If you didn't know that, that was a little clip from the great movie Jaws, when I forget the actor's name. He's throwing fish out the back of the boat, right? And he sees the mouth of Jaws, and we're going to need a bigger boat because the enemy, so to speak, is that would be Roy Scheider, eh? Oh, very good, very good. Thank you, Nick. he sees the enemy is bigger than you realize, so that you need a bigger vessel from which to do your duty and obligations and fight the good fight. I've always associated that little analogy of we need a bigger boat to I need the biggest church that I can belong to. I need a church that is the biggest vessel of support, the biggest vessel of grace, the biggest vessel of truth. And when you look around and weigh all the candidates for such a position, that Catholicism always, in my humble estimation, wins hands down. So many churches are associated nationalistically with different groups of people, perhaps not officially so, but practically so. What do I mean by that? Like Lutheranism, for instance, is not officially just for Germans, but it certainly, since it was born in Germany, and you got a upper hand if in the hierarchy of the Lutheran Church, if you are of German ancestry. A lot of those Protestant denominations have that spirit. Except, well, I got to add this. Maybe people don't really know this, but with the dawning, with the birth of the United States of America, with our beautiful yet beautiful yet, I'm going to say, dangerous. That's maybe too powerful of a word. It's a beautiful yet complicated doctrine of religious freedom. I'll say it that way. Freedom, we don't want to associate it with danger, but in some ways it is, okay? But with the birth of the United States of America, with our strong emphasis on religious freedom, thousands and thousands of new denominations sprung up, and it's a little hard to associate a nation with the many new modern Protestant denominations like Lutheranism is associated with Germany. And of course, even Islam is worldwide, and it's not officially proclaimed or connected to the Middle Eastern nations, but the Arab-speaking world is a community of nations in which the Islamic faith is very strong, and outside of it, it is relatively weak. So a religion can be associated with one nation or a conglomeration of nations that are united in some natural way, like language, I guess, obviously. But anyways, the United States of America is a little hard to peg like that because we are an eclectic collection of peoples from many nations. And so the Protestant denominations that have been spawned in the history, the 200-year history of the United States, really do carry with them you could say that the nation they are associated with is the United States of America. You say, well, that's not a nation. Well, yes, it is, and it's becoming more so. When you think about it, in the past, it almost was as if the United States of America was not a nation. And I have even heard Europeans say as much, even in recent days. The United States is not a nation. They'll say it as plain and clear as that, which indicates like someone from outside is assessing us in a way that we don't really want to be assessed. Am I making myself clear, or it's a little bit ambiguous? We're going to have to unpack this a little bit, but first we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with some other endeavors of the news and theology, even today and across the centuries. That's because you're listening to Father Tom Coy's In the Brain-Wrinkling Hour of the Winds of Change. Listeners supported the Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the Rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass. Also, at 5:30, a Spanish Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, Adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Kois here. So happy that you are sharing a little time with us on a cold January day. Not as cold as it was a few weeks ago, right? Hey, we're enjoying a little bit of a warm up here. Oh, wait a minute. You know, I just broke one of my little rules. Nick, I don't know if I need to put myself in the punishment room or not. Okay, very good. He thinks it was an innocent mistake because I did.
It's very rare.
Oh, I'm wait a minute. You just said I didn't have to go.
We're going to learn to be more professional. That's what you're going to do.
Okay, you know, sometimes it's a mark of high humility to put yourself in the punishment room. And I had to put myself in the punishment room because I just broke one of my little rules. I strive to share with all of you, our great listeners, topics that are timeless, topics that are not here today and gone tomorrow. When you tune into the Winds of Change, it's not like tuning into the news. You know how when you tune on the news, you want to hear what's the news today, even what's the news this hour. If there were a channel that broadcasted week-old news, it probably wouldn't be very popular, let alone one that broadcasted month-old or year-old, unless it were those stories that showed themselves to be not a prisoner of the news. The rapid news schedule, or the day, as it were. So, anyways, that's why when I said it's a cold day in January, and it's warmer now because it was colder over Christmas and New Year's. I broke that little rule. See, so if you are listening to this podcast and it is not the second week in January, and you look outside and it's a beautiful 60-degree day, then you'll. Please don't turn this show off, because we are going to get back to the matters of eternity, the big issues that span history. Okay, so I just had to take care of that. And in speaking of history, I have to share with you a beautiful, very interesting article by Bill Donahue, which probably many of you know is with the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights. And he's a great writer, and he's a great thinker, great a great faithful Catholic guy. Gotta give him so much kudos in all of that. And he has an article that we got to dive into here a little bit called The War on the Monuments. It's a topic, especially near and dear to my heart, because the tearing down of the Confederate statues is seen as a way of participating in the virtues of the Civil War, the American Civil War, right? If you are proud that the North won the Civil War, if you are glad that the central issue of slavery was finally overcome by freedom, you might say, oh, yeah. Hi,
hello there, Peabody here.
Oh, hello, Peabody.
Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
Well, if we're talking about the Civil War, I could say the 1860s, right? But if I'm talking about the tearing down of the Confederate statues, we got to go much farther into the future than that, into the contemporary years. But let's analyze. I got to share with you some really very an interesting side of that debate. From Bill Donahue. As I say, it's something near and dear to my heart because my book, the book that everyone should and can be reading, is called The Ashes That Still Remain. The Ashes That Still Remain. the title itself is pointing exactly to this conflict that's happening now. The title of my book is referencing the fact that the Civil War obviously was a tremendous conflict over issues, over people who are holding on to these issues, and it's good for us to try to understand them. I love the quote by John Adams when he was in France and he was talking to the ambassadors and all the kings and the princes, and he says, I have to study war so that we can avoid it in the future. I have to study war so that my children can study agriculture. He knew that there was a lot to learn about planting corn and all the rest. You know, what he learned in his time was a lot of great stuff, but compared to what we know now, he was a uncivilized planter of seeds. Anyways, so that's why it is valuable to keep our mind open and look at it and examine these issues of the wars of our society. It's forever a cloud in the heart of my mind. Oh, can we say that? Sometimes people like to say it's in my mind or it's in my heart, but I like to combine them. It's in the heart of my mind that I love people, and yet civilization has always been at war. So why we need to understand why people come to hate and kill each other in our wars, and the more we can learn about them, the better. So the book that I put together called The Ashes That Still Remain is trying to highlight this aspect of the Civil War that is still alive today. There's still ashes, there's still sparks, there's still a smoldering from the Civil War that exists in the world today in our modern contemporary society. Yet, and here's the big yet, the example of the anger with which those who are tearing down the Confederate statues are being driven by, and Bill Donahue says that it's being driven by hate. He just comes right out and say that it's the hate that is driving it. I would have to agree. Before I use that word, I'll say it's being driven by a wrong assessment of the first principles of the Civil War, a wrong assessment of the first principles of the Civil War. What do I mean by that? Obviously, the people that want to tear down the statues are...
Wow. You just wrinkled my brain, man.
All right. Is that two or three, Nick? We still got time here in our beautiful... Anyways... The assessment of the first principles of the Civil War, people would say, well, there's no argument about it. It was about racism. Right? It was about racism. How can you think of anything else? How could you say anything different? I could say something different because you need to push your mind a little deeper and say, what's the matter? What's wrong with racism? And wait a minute, don't say I'm saying there's nothing wrong with racism. When someone says what's wrong with racism, that could have two meanings, right? It could mean, hey, I'm a racist and there's nothing wrong with it. That's one meaning. A second meaning, if I say what's wrong with racism, I could be saying, as a philosopher and a theologian, I want to know the reasons why it is wrong. I want to appreciate the principles that are wrong that sustain it. Are you following me? that's what I mean by what's wrong with racism. And the principles that sustain it, or you could say the principle that sustains it, is the inability to recognize the human person as a human person and to treat human persons with dignity and with respect, with equal justice under the law. These other things follow it. But that the first principle that deigns racism wrong is the principle that you must recognize human beings as human persons. And the inability to see a human being as a human person is what fueled the racist culture. And of course, it must be said, it must be stated, we must be reminded that it wasn't only in the United States of America, it was all throughout the history of the world. Are those Confederate soldiers heroes today? They are, in a sense, the only kind of heroes that receive praise today. What do I mean by that? They are the only kind of hero that is fighting for something they believe in. Okay? They right or wrong, sincerity trumps virtue. Where sincere passion is more praiseworthy than even timid holding on to a very true principle about human life. Okay, so we'll come back here again. Man, time's flying. We'll come back. I promise you some of these interesting quotes by Bill Donahue in his very interesting article called The War on Monuments. Okay, I'm Father Tom Coyes. Happy to be here sitting in for Father Anthony Bush, whom we're praying for. Maybe if Father Bush gets to listen to this, God love you, and we're praying for you, and we want you back fast and strong. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
We at Winds of Change thank you for your prayers and financial support. As you have often heard, Winds of Change is listener-supported. That means you, and especially now. Please give what you can to help support Winds of Change to stay on the air. Any amount will be greatly appreciated. Simply go to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And click on the radio button to make your donation to Winds of Change, which will be a tremendous blessing. Thank you.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule, work, or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you for being with us in this hour of power of Catholic theology, philosophy, psychology, history, and any other isms that you can think of. Yes, and it is your doorway to heaven. I'm glad there's the reward room. You got the reward. Maybe you missed it earlier in the show, my friends. But I myself was in the punishment room because I made a little faux pas of my radio professionalism here. But be that as it may, I try to be try to help wrinkle your brain, and I need to be an example, and humility is it's a good virtue. I have to tell this little story about humility. If there's any priests listening, you'll know what I'm talking about. And people who are really involved in parishes will probably know. But every now and then, we get evaluated. There's evaluations for priests. I feel it's sometimes a little misguided in the sense that the ones who should be primarily in the evaluation ministry should be the bishops above the priests. But in our contemporary system of priestly evaluations, bishops have primarily delegated that all to official commercial industrial organizations that do evaluations, and they can and all, I must say that they do a pretty good job, but they often miss what is a deeper and crucial aspect of successful versus unsuccessful parish priests, especially when it comes in terms of defending the faith, being a prayerful and striving after holiness, and a charitable heart, and the good administrative side comes in there. Remember the three things that a child is baptized under. When we put the holy oil on the child's head, we say, you are now part of the priesthood of Christ, priest, prophet, and king. Priest, prophet, and king. The priesthood is especially reminiscent of the office of sacrifice, the one who offers sacrifice. And of course, the Catholic priesthood is distinguished primarily and essentially from the Old Testament priesthood of the Levitic order by incorporating an interior personal sacrifice as opposed to an external objective sacrifice. If that's not too clear, let me make it clear. The Old Testament priesthood was based on the killing of animals. The New Testament priesthood of the Catholic Church is based on the greater sacrifice of your life, often symbolized but not exclusively defined as the acceptance of celibacy as a form of sacrifice in order to serve the church better. Okay, so, but that evaluation process does encourage us. I think all of us priests, when we think about these things, as almost anybody who's in any kind of job, when you're thinking of you're getting evaluated, make you a little nervous. Yeah.
You just wrinkle my brain.
Can wrinkle your brain. Here's how I'm going to wrinkle your brain again, is because I was struggling with just dealing with that evaluation process until I realized, now, wait a minute. If you're striving after holiness, then humility has to be one of the virtues you're going to take on. And I just thought of some of the many saints that have been great examples of humility. And one of the saints that is a great example of humility that comes to mind is St. John Vianney. And a wonderful friend of mine, one of our, CCD director, co-director, maybe some of you out there know Mr. Jim Coughlin. He reminded me of the story of St. John Vianney when many people were writing the bishop and saying that this priest is driving us crazy and he's a really bad priest. They wanted the priest to remove St. John Vianney from his parish. And so they passed around a petition stating all his negative characteristics. He's impatient, he's rude, he's not prayerful, he's ignorant about this, he's not very well educated. Well, anyways, St. John Vianney gets wind of the letter. He finds someone passing it around. He said, "Oh, can I see that letter?" And he reads it. He takes it and he reads all these awful things about himself. And he says, "Oh, wow, I agree with all of those." And he himself signs the petition. And it's just a powerful story of someone's saintly humility. And I had to share this when I was discussing with the professional team that was behind the evaluation process that we just went through. And I said, when you were organizing the questions for all of this, all these evaluations, what Catholic saints did you have in mind? You know, we're supposed to try to model ourselves on the best, right? So if you were evaluating a baseball player, someone who is trying to improve their batting skills, would you not try to consult the best batters? You need to see what sluggers are doing and what they how they hit all their home runs and the rest, and then you try to help evaluate the novice hitter in light of the great hitter. And in an analogous way, for me as a Catholic priest, the great hitters, the superstars, are the saints. And so if I'm not striving to imitate some of the saints, if I don't have that that model in mind, then a lot of this evaluation is going to be sloughed off to the side. I frankly have to say, I talked to one of the parishioners who was kind enough to fill out my evaluation, and she said, you know, there wasn't anything in this evaluation about the priest's prayer life. And she was right. It didn't occur to the team of PhDs who have studied long and great hours and years in psychology classes to make the connection. If a priest loses his prayer life, he's probably not going to be a good pastor. That's what my parishioner was saying, and thanks be to God, she thought she was grateful that her pastor had a prayer life. Though I myself put down a number, I need to pray more. From my perspective, I need to pray more. I could easily say I need to grow in that. Anyways, so okay, that's an issue of today here. Now we're gonna. Bill Donahue has an interesting take on those taking down of the monuments. Okay, because he connects it to. The fact, and this is what we gotta accept here, my friends, that human beings throughout the different ages of history are a mixed bag, right? They're a mixed bag, and we have to use deeper appreciation of the good and the bad in each. And to tear down the statues without recognizing the courage of those soldiers to fight for something they believed in is to really diminish the virtue of courage. And fighting for your homeland, fighting for your family, as it were. And so can we take our hats off to them? I think we can. As a matter of fact, many times when you watch some of the very interesting movies and stories about the American Civil War, you often see Union soldiers having a deep respect for the Confederate soldiers that are trying to kill them, and vice versa. Hopefully that is the case as well. You have to respect someone's sincere passion for what they believe in, though you can add they're sincerely wrong. Now that's what today we have a tremendous difficulty in accepting. There is no official, objective, officially wrong. There is only passionate defense of what you believe in. If you believe it, then you have a right to fight for it. And that's why if you can connect the first principle, namely the failure to see the value of the human person as what the vice of slavery is built on, then you can see that's the ashes that still remain today, because today we have another blaring example of how our society is failing to recognize the dignity and the personhood of a group of people. What am I referring to? Obviously, if you've listened to me before and you're on, it's the right to life issue. The unborn child today is standing in the place of the slavery of 150 years ago. And the fact that so many of the angry, passionate people who think that they have to stamp out racism today while they, at the same time, bend over backwards to defend and put into political action the defense of the unborn, they are actually taking up the side of the Confederacy because they're making the same mistake. And that's so important. And Bill Donahue brings out the issue saying that the people that are people all throughout history are a mixed bag. And one of the things that they're a mixed bag, the abolitionists of the 1850s and 60s, here's an answer to one of my deeply felt frustrations of modern day Catholic life. The abolitionists, almost all of them, also were bigots. In the sense, I said, wait a minute, how can they be bigots? They're anti-slavery. Isn't the definition of a bigot someone who is a white supremacist and one who is in favor of slavery to the blacks? That is one incarnation of the idea or of the characteristic of being a bigot, but it is not the only one. In fact, the word bigot is often used in the gay rights realm and debates. People who are for marriage between a man and a woman are often considered bigots by those who are strong defenders of same-sex so-called marriages. And so the word bigot is not just confined to race issues in terms of black and white. And I think we all can agree with that and know that. But what is not appreciated, not seen, and what Bill Donahue points out is that so many of the abolitionists of those days were anti-Catholic bigots. And so what he's, again, remember, he's president of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights, something similar to like the Jewish Defense League. When Catholics get the snub, when Catholics are treated unjustly, when Catholics are unfairly criticized, etc., he's going to try to shed some light on how we should react. And so if he were living in the 1850s and 60s, he would constantly be trying to defend Catholics for their right to be Catholic. So it is that the abolitionists had their black eye, so to speak, or we say warts, when we say love me, warts and all. And the Southern Confederacy had its black eye and its warts as well. That's another... Well, investigating and analyzing these things, We have to keep that in mind. How do we unpack? Let me just go a little bit farther in here as Bill Donahue elaborates. He gives some examples. He says most Americans today think that the anti-Catholicism of the 1800s was the product of uneducated nativists. Uneducated nativists. It's our country, stay out. Obviously, because so many immigrants were coming and so many immigrants were Catholic as they came. But he says the truth is that the biggest anti-Catholic bigots were also the most liberal and most educated segment of the population. It was they who set the cultural tone against Catholics. Let me go on a little bit further. In his masterful book, Catholicism and American Freedom, historian John McGreevy offers plenty of evidence to back up his charge that those who supported abolitionists typically saw Catholicism and slavery as one and the same thing. Now, there's a thought to wrinkle your brain, isn't it? Because today we don't think of that, but he's saying both were seen as despotic systems. Indeed, the first abolitionist martyr, Eli Lovejoy, I thought it would be John Brown, but Eli Lovejoy was even before John Brown. He spent much of 1835 warning of the Catholic menace to the American experiment. That's why, my friends, I often bring to my show here little clips and examples when dealing with our love for country and the distinctions between Protestantism and Catholicism. It's a very important distinction. And to address some of these issues with reverence, with kindness, with tolerance, is quite important for helping save our dear, precious country and our church. I like some of you may know who listen to this talk show, also might catch a Larry Elder in the evenings now. He's here in the Chicago market, and his little byline sometimes is, "Hey, we got a nation to save." I kind of have to admit, I agree with him. We got a nation to save. I would add, we have to save America, but we won't be able to save it without a strong dose of Catholicism. This is the sad truth that runs through my bones, is that the state of Protestant Christianity isn't strong enough to save America. Yet there are many who would say that it is Catholicism that is perhaps as much of a danger to the future as others. There's a new book, and gosh, I wish I had the author and right on tip of my tongue, but I'll try to get it, and maybe we'll try to do some future shows on it, called Reviving the Reformation. Reviving the Reformation as a stepping stone to helping save America. And my first and immediate thought, maybe it's yours, I hope it is, we have to think in terms of revitalizing or reigniting the Reformation as a way to help save America today is really misguided, in the sense that the origins of the Reformation were completely hatched in the very direct and very practical conflict over Catholicism versus the newly developed Protestant versions. You can't call it one version, but they all were united in their anti-Catholicism, at least in that sense. But that context is no to revive the roots and the origins of the Protestantism as a way of saving the United States of America today is misguided because the enemy is not Catholicism. you can't really appreciate and understand the Reformation if you remove Catholicism from the discussion. If you remove Catholicism from the discussion, you have no Reformation. And so to try to revive the Reformation in the 21st century and find the principles that hatched the Reformation, you're going to come up shorthanded, as I say, because the force that is preventing a rebirth of Christianity is not Catholicism in the United States. It is the strong and radical secularism that is an equal enemy and in many times ways a stronger enemy of Catholicism versus Protestantism. Why can I say that? Because there's very few Protestant principles, shall we say, at stake in the Supreme Court decisions that are threatening to sue, like the Little Sisters of the Poor, and they're being forced to pay for contraception and all the rest. Since I brought that up, but we're going to have to get into this because so often when I hear on the news the highlighted example of the poor, Little Sisters of the Poor, and they're standing against, I'm glad it's there because they're acting as an example for others. Nationwide, as it were. However, it's a weak example because because so many Catholics, general Catholics, don't understand why it's wrong. they say, oh, okay, I could see why celibate women taking care of elderly in nursing homes, they're not going to want to pay for contraception. However, most Catholics completely agree with it. And if you're not a nun in one of those institutions, if you're a cook or a housekeeper or an accountant in the office and you have your family matters to worry about, then you're going to... So I think the American, the United States Bishops Conference is a little in the dark, a little naive in the sense that they don't realize, maybe they do realize it, but they're not acting on their realization that battle is not as strong of an example, a leading battle as we might think it is. So, anyways, oh my gosh, let me give one more thing where this Elijah Lovejoy, who was in the early 1800s, was a rabid anti-Catholic Presbyterian minister, and he believed that slavery was a papist product because there was such an antagonism towards Catholicism. You're not going to tell, no outside authority is going to tell me, the individual, how to lead and practice my Christian faith. They saw that as a form of slavery. And so they, despite the fact that popes had condemned slavery in many ways, Mexico had outlawed slavery before America. England had, in many places. The fact that people didn't listen very well doesn't mean that they didn't try. Pope John Paul II was condemning abortion and contraception, but still goes on. So, let's pray for all these things, my friends, because I wrinkle your brain, but have hope and have trust that the good Lord will guide us through. I'm Father Tom Coys. This is Listener Supported, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Meaningless thought, the shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.